So welcome to the CMO Fractional Marketing, Fractional CMO podcast. This is our second episode of this series. It makes us sound very professional when we have different series, but we've realigned what we're doing. This podcast now is specifically about fractional CMOs, talking to fractional CMOs, understanding how they work, talking to clients who've used fractional CMOs, and so on and so forth. So if you want to find out a bit more about us, check out our website, www.cemoh.com. That's spelled C-E-M-O-H. If you want to reach out to me, my name is Simon Dell. I am on LinkedIn, pretty much everywhere else. You can email me at simon@cemoh.com. And if you enjoy this podcast and think it's pretty cool, then it would be really helpful if you could write us a nice review, give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else that you are listening to us. That's pretty much the boring introduction out of the way. And we're going to jump in to the meat and bones, but that makes him sound kind of, that's very strange. But welcome to the podcast today, a gentleman by the name of Jamie Gilbert Smith. Thank you for joining us, mate.
Oh, pleasure to be here, Simon.
Now, you have I was going to say colourful history, but colourful is probably the wrong word, but an interesting history of both client side, agency side, and you are you're fresh meat on the on the fractional CMO platter. So we're going to talk to you about that, but first things first, let's get the overview about the Jamie story in sort of, you know, the edited highlights of the Jamie story.
Yeah, sure. So, summing up 25 years, and that makes me feel very old. But 25 years, most of which was agency side, but I spent the last marketing director at Nine Entertainment Company, which is Channel 9, but also it's streaming, it's publishing, it's audio, it's the creative services, it's the whole gamut. And my remit was to look after all B2B marketing at Nine. And that involved really trying, you know, driving our brand, driving our revenue, driving partnerships and leveraging both our internal properties. So let's take Married at First Sight through to the AFR, or partnerships with the Olympics and Paralympics, so external partners, and then taking those to market, trying to engage and educate the commercial audience. Probably the biggest highlight was I ran our annual upfront, which is a annual showcase to the market, investors, politicians, et cetera, and we'd consume about 6 months of the year in planning. So it's a beast. Yeah. 2,000 people in the room, 7,000, 8,000 online. So no pressure. and then also, you know, commercializing our Olympics and Paralympics, driving 140 million in commercial revenue, which is above our target.
So just to interrupt there, when you say commercializing the Olympic, presumably that means that you're sort of responsible of getting in the advertisers and partners that are going to essentially give Channel 9 money in order to be visible during that spectacular, you know, sporting event.
Yeah, exactly. And there's different ways you can do it, right? So if you're a brand, you can either buy spots and dots or 30, you know, your typical 30-second, 15-second kind of ad hoc airtime. But before that, you were really looking for the big commercial partners who are going to have deep integration within the broadcast beyond just simple advertising. And those partnerships, you know, they're double-digit millions. And the challenge we had is, if you think about the last real Olympics that we had, where there was, you know, an audience and not COVID impacted, was Rio 2016.
Yeah.
And the medium age of a media agency person who's making a lot of the buying decisions is kind of high, about 28.
Yeah.
They were at high school or uni when Rio happened. So we had to bring to life and contextualize the importance of something like the Olympics and Paralympics Yeah, we created commercial packages for it, but you've got to go out to the and engage the market and persuade them to spend, significant amounts of money in something that was going to be on largely overnight in
Yeah.
Paris.
That's
So,
that can't have been an easy job then. That
no, so we
sounds
did about, God, I think it was 25 different events.
right.
And we created podcasts and we did a lot of content. And, did I think three or four different iterations of the commercial pitch to the market as things sold and you then changed what you were packaging up. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. And what I found really interesting was the shift from being agency side where you're an earner to being
Yeah.
client side where you're a spender. But what you quickly find is that what you get to spend gets reduced very quickly when you're working for a legacy media company that's in a declining ad market. So
Yeah.
we had a real focus on our earned media as much as our paid.
And just to touch base with that agency experience. So that was MSC Saatchi. And you were there for quite a long time. Was it 8 years,
Yeah, I
something
was
like
there
that?
for 8 years and I headed up MNC Saatchi Sport and Entertainment, which was one of 12 companies at the time with, under the MNC umbrella. And then I sat on the leadership team as well. And what we did was work with the likes of CommBank, Optus, Woolies, the Australian Olympic Committee, Swimming Australia to either look at how to commercialize their assets. So, like Swimming Australia, how do you go to market and attract brands to come on board as a commercial partner? Or the other side of it, which was you've got a CommBank that is looking to leverage its sponsorship of the cricket and how does it do that?
Right.
And I don't really like the word sponsorship because it was what we were doing was more than that. So what we were focused on was really providing a real life tangible proof point to, a brand proposition, which is lots of marketing jargon. But what that basically means is I'm a cynic when it comes to advertising and I don't believe ads necessarily can do all the heavy lifting on their own because they're one way, it's one way communication. And if your starting point is, okay, I'm going to start with my customer and what they care about. And then I'm going to think about what it is I want to be talking about. I need to put it into their world in their context because otherwise they're probably not going to listen to me.
Yeah.
And so if you do things around, things that matter to them, like cricket or music, or you find a passion platform, and then you find a way to sympathetically bring your brand to life within that environment. You can
Yeah.
create a much stronger connection with customers than you can with just pure advertising. And an example of the proof of that was when we did CommBank Cricket, and they had the Royal Commission. The only piece of communication that the bank did that drove positive sentiment in that year was our cricket work.
Right.
And we did work where they were like, hang on, we've had zero negative comments in our socials. It sounds stupid, right? But you
Yeah.
go, well, if you're a bank and you're on social, invariably there's somebody going, oi, give me a better mortgage or
Yeah.
stronger language, not safe for a PG podcast like this.
No, there's plenty of swear words in this. So, and I'm going to jump ridiculously far forward here because that sort of relationship is, I again, obviously at a bigger scale, we're talking, millions and millions of dollars in international cricket and, large scale banks. But that's something that's probably really important just to the average business, the smaller businesses. What from that would you say was a key learning? It sounds like finding that sort of passion seems to be the cornerstone. But if you were talking to a normal smaller business owner today, how would you translate what you've done on such a massive scale to sort of a smaller business?
Yeah, it's really easy. It's really easy. There's a basic fundamental, which is if you've got to start with your audience first. None of this will sound like super smart, but not many people are doing it, right? So you start with the audience, think about what they care about. And I've said to people, there's what your audience cares about. There's what you want to talk about. And if you imagine a Venn diagram, if you're really, 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 really lucky, those two things might slightly overlap.
Yeah.
But invariably they don't. And yeah. So you've got to start with what they, you know, what they care about, what are their motivations, and then work back from that. So, you know, I had a conversation with who I won't name, but I had a conversation with a beer company, and they were talking about their products and say, but we've got the best hops and we've won all these awards. I'm like, but a customer walking up to a bar doesn't give a crap about that, really. Well, sure, if the beer stinks, then they'll know about that. But if you're, what differentiates is not the hops. What differentiates is the story behind the brand. And I will, you know, prime example, we're up here in Queensland. Forex Gold used to be the market dominator. They used to be my client. And some people in CUB and head office in Melbourne decided to come up with a beer called, you know, Great Northern.
Yeah.
And basically position it as a beer for fishermen, hunters, etc. And now I've had people going, you know, I ask them why they drink it, and they go, well, it's a Queensland beer. It's from here. I'm like, it's a Japanese-owned beer that was come up with in a brainstorm in Victoria.
Yeah.
And you're buying the brand. You're drinking the brand. And so you can apply that thinking to any business, right? How do you start with customer first?
That digressing there, that was a relatively that was a masterstroke on CUB's point, and they'd spent many, many years trying to get a cut of the Queensland market by flogging VB. And, you know, and this, the Queensland market just did not want to drink VB. And, you know, obviously somewhere in a boardroom, somewhere in CUB, someone made the wise decision that, you know, creating something that had a perception of origin, I guess, because I mean, it was made down in Yatala, which is technically Queensland, but as you say, none of it is really Queensland, is it?
Manufactured, it's not.
The heart doesn't belong. Yeah, yeah.
It's heart, you know.
Yeah,
it's a brand. It's a story.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, again, digressing off, but I used to have those conversations with Heineken about, you know, people would go, I'm not going to drink Heineken unless it was the Heineken that was brewed in Amsterdam. And then all of a sudden they start drinking it in Sydney and everybody drinks Heineken. Nobody's sort of suddenly coming back to that message later on. You know, it's yeah. Anyway,
but if you wanted to take it even smaller than that, if you think about small choices you make,
yeah,
you know, what real estate agent do you go with? It's about mental availability. It's about being present in your mind when you come to the buying decision, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason why your local, retail agent will sponsor the local football team, you know, the grassroots football team. It's because, you know, you've got to remember that only 5% of your customer is ever in market at any one time for your product. So there's 95% of them who aren't in market. So you need to be selling into, like, building that mental availability and that presence in their mind to the point when they are in the decision-making, in that purchase moment, that you're top of mind.
Yeah.
And so you can apply that to all these small businesses as well.
So out of what you've done in the past, what do you consider your strengths, when you stand in front of a prospect client, and why Jamie above anybody else?
Well, I think that's partly how I position my consultancy, is around simplicity, but reducing noise to focus on what's effective, right? And whether that's thinking about the audience first, I'll go back to thinking about the audience first. It's, you know, whether it was trying to sell the Olympics to a media buyer or it's trying to flog beer for Forex Gold, it's kind of audience first marketing. But I think what a lot of people get trapped with is they can understand that as a theory, but in practice, they're so bogged down in their businesses. It's, you know, they've got legacy behaviors, or that, you know, they've got legacy structures. They can't see the wood for the trees. They're freaking out about AI. And what I bring is 25 years of experience, but really an external perspective to help shine a light on actually what they should be doing and what's going to shift the dial.
Yeah. And so given all that, you know, I think that's, you know, that's a great answer. Where do you still see yourself developing in terms of, you know, skills or understanding? Because, well, I'll end the question there. Where do you think you've still got opportunities to develop?
Well, so I mean, AI, the whole, yep. But, you know, where's that going to fit in? How, you know, and I'm not going to make this about AI for the podcast, because you're going to be pushing this out on LinkedIn, where every other post is about AI. But it's clearly a thing that's here, and we need to learn about it. And yeah. You know, as a senior marketer, which is a nice polite way of saying getting old, you need to stay relevant. And, you know, yeah. So I play Roblox with my kids, and, you know, I hate it, and Minecraft. But I want to go see what's in their world, right? And you got to stay curious, and you got to keep learning. So that's probably the big one. And then the shift from being in a company to being, you know, my own consultancy, is another one where you've got to balance, kind of how you scale selectively. Yeah. How do you turn down a good opportunity to go with a great one?
Yeah.
And then also, how are you on the balcony and the dance floor at the same time? Right.
Yeah.
Because you got to roll up your sleeves and get busy, but at the same time, you've got to keep that strategic view.
Mm.
And, you know, it's kind of what I was just talking about in terms of what I offer to businesses as an external edge, you know, an experienced external perspective. I know that I will be in that point as well, where I'll need people around me who give me their external perspective and hold up a mirror.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do it all on your own.
Yeah. So you've had this, I was going to say, glittering career. Agency side, and obviously working with some huge brands, Channel 9, you've now done the thing where you're like, hey, I'm going to go and do this all on my own now. What led you to that decision? What was there a light bulb moment, or is that something that had been sort of just brewing over time?
I think somebody said to me, oh, you're going to miss working on all these big brands. It's like, not really. And who's to say I won't be working with them anyway?
Yeah.
But I think working for a big organization, I mean, it's no secret that Nine had a shit show of a cultural review last year. 30% of people interviewed, over 1,000 people, had experienced sexual harassment, and 60% had experienced workplace bullying. I don't want to be in that environment again.
Yeah.
So being out on my own allows me to, some degree, pick and choose who I work with, and I'm quite motivated by seeing, you know, working with smaller companies and smaller businesses where you can see the impact of your work more immediately, and you can see it in the human level as well, right? If you're dealing with a founder, or you're dealing with a, you know, owner operator, this isn't just a 3-year gig and then they'll move on to something else. This is their life.
Yeah.
And so that becomes a much more powerful motivator than, you know, shifting brand preference on CommBank. That said, you know, I do love working with CommBank. So, you know, we did some,
is that
some great
you just
work.
Like going to the cricket, or that was that? Oh,
exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it's not, one is not necessarily better than the other, but I just, I'm at a point where I want to be able to pick and choose who I work with.
Yeah.
Both in terms of within my team and also within with clients as well.
Yeah.
Which is why I've created the model I've created, which is, so I've what I'm calling a fractional agency.
Yeah.
So I'll go in as a consultant, but I've got a bench of talent that I can reach out to and go, okay, I'll curate a team to solve a problem. Rather than I'm going to go hire a bunch of people and then sweat on the fact that I've got to utilize them.
Yes.
Because a lot of those people aren't necessarily, Yeah, in that old agency model, I'll have people that aren't necessarily the right fit for the client's problem, but my problem is I need to utilize them. So, yeah, so it's a fractional agency is the idea. So instead of having a, you know, building out a team that you employ that you then have to worry about utilizing, I come in as a consultant, have a bench of talent that I've built up over, you know, many years. And once I've understood what the client problem is, I will curate a team to fit that, to solve that problem, rather than in an agency model, the client's got a problem and I'll go, well, I've got old mate over here who's at 60% utilization.
Yeah.
They're perfect for your job. And it's like, well, no, I'm solving my problem. I'm not solving the client's problem.
Yeah.
Because the client, you know, that person may not be fit for purpose for the problem that the client's got. Also means I don't carry the overhead, right? So I can come in more cost effectively. And also, I'm a senior strategist, right? You don't need me on a full-time basis. So I come in and quite often would then hand over to other capabilities and get the hell out of the way. And you can still be there and check in, and but you know, you don't need to employ me on a full-time basis.
It's why I think the fractional model is works so well, and I think the more and more people learn about it, the more it's going to be, you know, it's going to be utilized in both sides of the equation. I think, you know, there's a lot of agencies that are looking at it now going, I don't need to carry a full-time creative, I can just use a fractional, you know, art director or senior creative or graphic designer when I need one. And again, I think that's always been there, but I just don't think it's potentially been recognized as an option. It was, you know, I don't think people saw it as a way of building value in their business. I think they saw it as a means to an end. And I think now people can look at it and go, okay, this is actually a viable way of building the talent pool that I need without the massive overheads associated with it.
Yeah, and I think I've interviewed a fair few ex-clients and agency people about the model. And it used to be that, you know, feedback from people is that it used to be that you'd want continuity of capability in your resource. And so you'd go with the one agency and you'd only stick with those people because they knew your business inside out.
Yeah.
But actually, people are getting more promiscuous because, A, they haven't got the budgets to afford big retainers, and B, they want diversity of thought. They want different thinking. And this allows you to do it. I've also run in-house teams. I ran an in-house team at Nine. And if you think about it, half the time you don't need to employ those people on a full-time basis, right? At Nine, we did very little marketing in December and January. We had an events team that would have been putting on the Australian Open in February, so they would be working. But in theory, you didn't need to pay me from the kind of 15th of December to the 15th of January. And then multiply that across a whole bunch of roles, and you're going to save a whole bunch of money.
Yeah. I think there was a couple of years ago, not last Christmas, Christmas before that, I'd sort of, I think I must have sat there for about 4 or 5 weeks twiddling my thumbs going, What am I doing? What's happening here over that exact period, that sort of week before Christmas to, you know, middle of January, late January. And I was, you know, it kind of reflected to sort of say, there's a couple of important things to factor into that is that, yes, the client doesn't need you for that time. So taking their money feels a bit disingenuous over that time because, you know, hey, I'm on holiday, I'm on a beach or whatever. But I think also then as a fractional marketing, as a fractional CMO or any fractional marketing, you probably need to sit there and go, I need to earn 12 months salary in 11 months. You know, I need my cost to reflect that when I go and price myself up, because I need to sit there and go, let's assume that within 4 weeks, 5 weeks of the year, I'm just simply not going to be working. I'm not going to be invoicing anybody.
But on the flip side, I've spent 25 years PAYG paying 50% tax.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So look, in terms of you looking for businesses, is there a type of business that you're looking for? I mean, obviously you've obviously had background in, you know, sports and sporting properties and media and those kind of things. Is that where you want to sort of continue to play, or, you know, you think that's where your strength lies?
I've been asking myself the same question because I've got the diversity of the background, but I think, my experience is perfect for a rights holder looking to go to market and think about their commercial offering. It's perfect for anyone who's thinking about or is in sponsorship. And then there's also the B2B side of things from Nine, and there's not that many of us in the market who are good at B2B marketing. Mm. And so I'm having conversations with media owners, not Nine, but media owners who have got rid of their senior capability, have junior people in the role, but still need that strategic capability, you know, now to come in on a short-term sprint.
Yeah.
So there's a few different clients. And then, you know, I just came from an industry event for a totally different sector, but they're all in B2B, and they, you know, they all have different challenges on, you know, how do I engage government, or how do I engage, you know, wholesalers? You know, everyone needs to tell their story, though. Everyone needs to, you know.
Yeah, and everyone needs to find that connection. I think, as you said right at the start, everyone needs to find that. I love the Venn diagram example. I think that's a great one, and I will steal that many times in the future. But you're right, is that you sit there, and I know, ever think about us, I think about, you know, at SEMO, it's put that customer first thing is, what are the challenges that what's the customer passionate about, and what are we trying to present, and where's the overlap in that little Venn diagram? And you know, those questions sort of are swirling around in my head now enough. And it's amazing that, you know, I'm in marketing. I've been doing this for a long time, but still I ask myself those questions like once a month, you know, just to sit there and go, are we doing the right thing? Are we talking about the same thing that the customer's passionate about, you know, or are we, you know, do we have this illusion that that they have a problem that we can solve that isn't actually the problem? So it's interesting. All the things you've said today, I think, really are often really tough questions that businesses need to ask themselves more often.
So I think that's an interesting one for you to consider, is who your audience is.
Yeah.
Because you would say a fractional CMO, in theory, would be you'd go pitch it to a marketing department as an additional capability, but actually it's the CFO that's probably the one you want to engage, because CFOs are ruling the world at the moment.
That's true. So just to sort of finish up here, what are the, you know, you've gone out on your own, or you've decided to go out on your own, what's been the toughest bit so far? Is it the fact that there's not that, you know, that the regular paycheck isn't arriving in the bank account?
No, I think there'll definitely be those moments. And you know, it's difficult to, you know, when there are those moments, it's difficult to be in flow and be yourself. But I think the biggest one was having worked for these big companies. Yeah, let's say MNC Saatchi, you know, I was there for 8 years, but when I joined, you inherit a narrative, you inherit the brand, you inherit their language around strategy and all those things. And it's kind of, you're ripping off the safety net of that by going out on your own and creating your own brand and creating your own narrative and your own story. Sure, I'm leaning on all of that experience, but when it's you, that can be quite a vulnerable position to be in. Yeah. Probably the biggest learning I've had is, like, that's okay. It's okay to be vulnerable. And there's a hell of a lot of really good people out there that will give you the time of day and advice. And it's daunting, but it's also rewarding. You know, I spoke to prime example of that. I spoke to somebody I hadn't spoken to in about 7 years, who I worked with at MNC just yesterday. And he was talking about, you know, when you're out on your own, the highs are higher, the lows are lower, but they're yours.
Yeah.
And that's quite a big difference. And so, it's going to be a bit of a journey. But it's surely going to be an interesting one, and one that in theory I'm in control of.
And again, I'll ask you this question. I think you've probably answered it, you know, enough times during the session here, but what's that ultimate reward for you out of all of this?
Well, I think there's a financial one because I've got three young boys, but that would be a disingenuous answer, because if it was all about money, then I'd be going and trying to get the big job at the big company again. For me, it's really that sense of partnership and seeing the impact of your work on, you know, where you can actually see it and feeling like that there's a purpose to what you're doing. When you're, you know, one cog in a big machine, you know, I've got the 140 million for the Olympics and Paralympics, but that wasn't just me. There was a team of people, obviously. But that was a rare example where there's a really big tangible result. A lot of it is you're kind of just edging the machine forward. And I think, the realization of the output of your efforts is going to be really rewarding.
Yeah, it's from my perspective, I think, you know, I'd echo that as well. I think, I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm going to go and see a business tomorrow who's a small catering business that's you know, turning over $1 million. And when I first met her, she looked drained. She was like, I'm over this. I don't see her. You know, you get this vibe that she was like, how long do I keep doing this for? And what I hope to inject with her is to sit there and go, okay, here is a plan now. Here is a route for you to achieve what you want to achieve, you know, largely through marketing with a big dose of sales in the top of that. Operationally, I think she knows what she's doing operationally, but she's confused as to how the business grows in the position that she's in at the moment. And I think if I can go into that and say, these are the things you need to do, and then help them through that and go, meet this person, they'll help you do this, meet this person, and make sure you're that sort of conductor of the orchestra, as it were. It is supremely rewarding. And yes, there's going to be moments when you're sitting in board meetings in other clients where you want to bash your head against the table and things like that. But for me, I echo what you've said there, is that you genuinely, and I don't want this to sound wanky or anything, but genuinely you can change people's lives. And I think that's a great legacy to want to leave behind.
Yeah. And I think within this is the variety as well of where you can pick and choose where you work. And, you know, I think that's bit of an unspoken benefit for being a fractional, is you can, you know, it's interesting. I've had conversations where I want to, I'm in conversations with a kids charity, which is really cathartic and a bit of a soul cleanse from some of the other jobs I've done in 25 years. But on the other hand, I'm talking to a guy about some, you know, tech platforms and taking that to market. And, you know, it's kind of weird penny drop moment because it's really obvious. But I was just like, halfway through the conversation, I was like, I can do actually what I want. not, I'm in the confines of a job description within the one organization doing the, you know, that's not to say I didn't have a shit ton of fun at, you know, especially in the sponsorship world where, you know, going to cricket and going to music and doing lots of interesting things. But I just, there's going to be a sense of autonomy, I think.
Okay. Last question then. If people want to reach out to you, obviously they can do that through SEMO, but if they want to reach out to you directly, you know, you're not hard to find on LinkedIn, but what's the new website and the new email address?
Yeah, so, well, LinkedIn's best, but, Occamstrategy.au is the website. But yeah, it's probably best go through LinkedIn. You'll find me, you'll find the website. And feel free to reach out on LinkedIn Messenger as well. Whether you want some advice, you're starting out in your own thing, you're stuck in corporate world and thinking, how do I get out and escape? Or if you're interested in, you know, some of my experience and how it might be able to help you, then, you know, give me a shout.
Awesome. Mate, thank you very much for your time today. It's going to be extremely enjoyable watching that, watching the business grow in the, you know, in the next 12 months and being part of that. So thank you for being on today.
No, thanks for having me.